This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 298 was recorded on November 18th, 2021. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole, and by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Alhambra Investment CIO Jeffrey Snyder returns as this week's feature interview guest, and I think you're really going to love this interview. Jeff gives the first truly credible counter-argument that I've heard to date for the secular inflation thesis that so many of our expert guests and I myself have come around to in the last couple of years. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled, Can the Trends Continue? And finally, you can expect Macro Voices to air one day early next week on Wednesday, November 24th, due to the American Thanksgiving holiday on November 25th.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, let's jump into S&P 500. I want to talk about a chart in the post game about it, but right now it looks pretty quiet. I mean, we haven't made a 52-week high in a week. It's crazy. But do you think the breakout potential's there?
Well, I certainly do. I mean, we're still above all of the short-term moving averages. I don't see any reason to think that the melt-up doesn't continue. To be sure, I don't think that this is about fundamentals. It's about liquidity, and it's central bank largesse that's driving that liquidity. But, you know, it's time, actually way past time, for me and everyone else who's been banging their fists saying, this is not based on fundamentals. It's unsustainable. Well, look, as long as the central bank continues to print money like it's going out of style, it is sustainable. And I think it's more likely to lead to an Austrian crack-up boom as opposed to a market crash in nominal terms. Eventually, it's going to end very badly, I think, potentially in an inflationary depression of some kind. But that's not happening anytime soon, and I don't see any reason not to expect the market to continue the melt-up.
All right, well, let's touch on the dollar index, because what a breakout we had to start last week. It really has been following through early on. A little bit of a reversal in the last few days. We cleared 96 temporarily on the upside of the dollar index. Coming back a little bit here, we're about 95.50 at the time of recording. What do you make of all the dollar strength?
Well, Patrick, I think you already said most of it. The strength continues. We broke 96. Of course, you break a round number level like that. Some people think it's going to be a top. They start selling, and that's the reason that you're seeing this retracement. That's perfectly normal. All bull markets climb a wall of worry. I think what's going on here is the Jeff Snyder view about dollar scarcity, the Brent Johnson view, dollar milkshake theory. If anybody's unfamiliar with those views, please check both Jeff Snyder and Brent Johnson's past interviews on Macro Voices. And of course, we've got Jeff Snyder coming back this week to talk about inflation.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil, because after what it was an epic two-month run on the upside, we've now seemed to be in the midst of some sort of a correction. How deep does go before a buying opportunity emerges?
Well, there's a lot going on here with the Biden administration, SPR releases, probably a little bit too much for the market rep. So let's save some of that extended commentary for the postgame segment when we'll go into a little more detail on what the options are for the Biden administration, because very clearly, Joe Biden has painted himself into a corner where he now has to do something, with do something in air quotes, about energy prices. It's not much he can really do. So let's talk about what those options are in the postgame segment. Meanwhile, EIA inventory came in with crude oil drawing down 2.1 million barrels, but that was really a 5.3 million barrel drawdown before a 3.2 million barrel SPR release. So net of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve release of 3.2 million barrels, this would have been a 5-plus million barrel drawdown during what should be restocking season, although we're getting kind of to the borderline of restocking season being over. And we ended up with a print of 2.1. Now, this is freaking everybody out completely. Oh, my God, what's going on? The SPR release, they're selling oil out of the SPR. Well, okay, look, let me read the press release. It says the DOE announces this morning the sale of 20 million barrels of oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. That press release was dated August 23rd. Why is Zero Hedge printing articles saying, we've just learned shocking information that there's, you know, this is crazy. This is not new information. And if you've been listening to Macro Voices just 2 weeks ago, I told you that there was a very significant SPR release, which turned what would have been a drawdown into a reported build. Nobody seems to have noticed the news, which was newsworthy on August 23rd, until this week. So much for the efficient markets hypothesis. Meanwhile, Cushing, Oklahoma, building. Finally, a build in Cushing, Oklahoma. Only 216,000 barrels, but it's not another huge drawdown. Remember, Cushing, Oklahoma is really close to its minimum operating level, and if it gets too much lower, we've really got an issue there. So it's really good to see at least some signs of stabilization. Meanwhile, gasoline drawing down 709,000 barrels, distillates drawing down 824,000 barrels, with U.S. production staying unchanged at 11.5 million barrels. We'll save the commentary on what the Biden administration's options are for the postgame segment, but the big picture here, Patrick, is I think the bottom of this correction comes at the moment of peak Biden administration stupidity. A lot of people are saying this morning might have been it. Maybe that was the bottom. I don't think the stupidity is done yet. I don't think that the Biden administration can just do nothing from here. They've made enough promises that they've got to do some kind of sign or something of doing something about this problem. And I'm not sure what that will be. Let's talk about it in the postgame segment. But I'm not convinced that the correction is over, because I don't think the stupid policy decisions from the White House are over.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because last week we're highlighting that very decisive breakout. It started the moment we had Ole Hansen on the show, and really it's been more or less holding the gains. I mean, we're at 1860 right now. Do you think there's that this is the legit breakout and we're going north of 19?
Well, I do think it's probably a legitimate breakout, but let's stop and remember that that breakout happened on a massive, massive, 30-year record CPI print. So finally, all the people that were in denial about inflation were given a wake-up call, and that jolted gold higher. Okay. Remember that usually what happens in technical analysis is breakouts, especially breakouts that happen on what might have been a one-off data print, tend to retrace at least back down to that prior resistance level. They test that as support, and then if it really is a healthy breakout, it's going to move up from there. So this seems to me like a perfect setup for that kind of retracement to happen. So yeah, I think it probably is a legit breakout. I think we probably are headed much higher, but I would be surprised if we don't see at least 1835, which I think is maybe where you want to start to add a little bit to a long position. And then 1815 looks like another good spot to add a little more. And I won't be at all surprised if we get back down to 1800, which is really where the breakout zone was, before this is over. Now, that doesn't mean it's bad. It's just this is the way breakouts tend to go, especially breakouts that happen on a data print. As people get all excited, once that excitement wears off, you see the market retrace back down to the breakout zone, and then it recovers from there. And if that happens, it's great. It's all off to the races. Let's see what happens, but I wouldn't be rushing to add a whole lot here. I'd be keeping some dry powder to see if that retracement gives you better location to add to your longs.
All right, well, let's touch on that 10-year yield. I'm sure Jeffrey Snyder is going to say something about it or another, but really at this stage, we had a yields generally rising over the last week toward 160, 165. We're still hovering there. Do you think that there's room for yields to break out to a fresh year high?
Well, I don't want to steal too much of Jeff Snyder's thunder, because he's going to talk a lot about bond yields in the feature interview. I'm just going to say that I don't think there's reason to get too concerned until we get past about 1.75 or so. That seems to be the red line in the sand where people start to panic. The question is, if we're headed towards secular inflation, you're going to hear Jeff Snyder make the argument that, hey, that never happens unless the bond yield predicts it first, and that's not happening yet. So we're not seeing that confirmation of secular inflation in the bond yields. And I think that's an important open question. I want to save that, though, for Jeff Snyder. Let's talk about it a little bit more in the postgame segment after Jeff's had his chance.
And Eric, as you were saying, this week's feature interview guest is Alhambra Investment CIO Jeffrey Snyder. Now, Eric, why did we get Jeff back on the show this week?
Well, Jeff is one of the absolute smartest guys that I've ever met in finance. And specifically, what he's smart about is understanding the international system for funding and creating U.S. dollars. The way that U.S. dollars are loaned into existence through the offshore euro dollar system. Jeff's done an incredible amount of work on that. He knows a lot about it. And when I hear somebody as smart as Jeff Snyder say, hey, I don't buy into this whole secular inflation argument, I think you guys all have it wrong. I really stop and listen because Jeff is somebody whose view I really respect. Now, I do want to add a little bit of context for our listeners before we get into this interview, because Jeff's such a smart guy, he sometimes assumes things are obvious that may not be obvious. Just for anyone who's not familiar with it, the formal definition of the word inflation in economics is not really the way most lay people use it. Lay people say inflation means rising consumer prices. An economist would tell you, actually, the definition of monetary inflation is a growing money supply. And the result of that larger money supply means there's more money in the system chasing the same amount of goods and services that results in an increase in consumer prices. So when you hear Jeff say that there are going to be significant consumer price increases, but it's not inflation, it sounds maybe initially like that's crazy. What is he talking about? Well, the distinction he's drawing is that it's not money supply inflation, which is driving that consumer price increase. Okay, who the heck cares? Jeff's going to make some really compelling arguments for why you should care, because if it's not monetary inflation driving it, then the expectations about how long it lasts, whether it's transitory or persistent, etc., change substantially. I don't necessarily agree with all of Jeff's views, but this is by far the most credible counterargument that I've heard so far for all of the excellent arguments we've heard in favor of secular inflation.
Well, Eric's interview with Jeffrey Snyder is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
This episode of Macro Voices was brought to you by Abex, a fintech company traded under ticker symbol ABXXF on the OTCQX in the United States and ABXX on the Equitas Neo in Canada. Abex was founded on the principle of creating market-based solutions to solve the world's most challenging problems. Two of these issues in particular, the energy transition and climate change, are creating once-in-a-generation opportunities for investors. Abex is leveraging proprietary Web 3.0 technologies to digitize and accelerate the velocity and security of commodity trading markets, beginning with liquefied natural gas and carbon. Investors seeking exposure to the fintech applications powering this new era of the ESG economy can visit www.abex.tech or www.abex.exchange, or check out ABXX on the Equitas Neo or ABXXF on the OTCQX exchanges.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Alhambra Investments Chief Investment Officer Jeffrey Snyder. Jeff has prepared a terrific slide deck to accompany today's interview. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, if you don't have a Research Roundup email, it means you haven't registered yet at macrovoices.com. Just go to the homepage, macrovoices.com, look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Jeff, I am really, really looking forward to this interview with you because you are one of the absolute smartest guys that I know, and you particularly understand the dollar funding system internationally. And for any listeners listening who are perhaps new to Macro Voices and are not aware, at macrovoices.com/EDU for Euro Dollar University, you can find a detailed series where Jeff explains the entire international global U.S. dollar funding system, the Euro Dollar system, which I think is going to play a role in today's discussion, the topic of which will be inflation. And particularly, Jeff, just about all of the smartest macro guys I know have kind of flipped from the deflation camp into the secular inflation camp. Just last week, we had Ola Hansen on this program describing how the lack of investment in oil-producing resources is likely to lead to a very significant oil price shock to the upside in coming years. And of course, oil prices, energy prices are one of the biggest drivers of inflation. I think we've gotten to the point, Jeff, where the last two men standing are you and Dr. Lacey Hunt. We're trying to get Dr. Lacey Hunt back on the program. Our producers are working on that. But let's start with our own Jeff Snyder, who knows the Eurodollar system so well. Why is it, Jeff, with everybody else saying, hey, look, secular inflation is just so clear. There's so many reasons to think that the MMT crowd is going to keep printing money, debasing currency, and so forth, has to lead to runaway inflation someday. You're saying, no, you don't see it. How come?
Well, there's two things here, Eric. And by the way, thanks for having me back on to try to explain what's going on here, because I think, you know, inflation is the one topic that everybody wants to talk about for very good reason. And when I say, you know, there isn't inflation happening this year, people are like, wait a minute, come on. The CPI is at 6.2% in October, which is the highest it's been in 30. How can you possibly say there's no inflation? And the answer is we have to define our terms. We have to be specific about what it is we're actually talking about. And the one part of it is what you just said, Eric, which is, you know, debasing the currency, money printing. And that gets to the heart of what we really want to talk about. But there's other things involved too, specifically to start with, you know, when we look at the CPI, is the CPI always talking about inflation? Is it always reflective of actual inflation? Or is there possibly different underlying, very different underlying circumstances that could be creating consumer price bubbles or, you know, consumer price deviation? That's the first thing. When we look at the CPI, is the CPI really just an inflation index, or is it a consumer price index where consumer prices could be moved by other factors that aren't inflation? And, you know, it's understandable why people would think that it's only the other, that CPI is always inflation, because that's really how everybody talks about it. And it's true not just to the public, but also central bankers and economists. You know, they do all sorts of studies, for example, about the CPI and what's the best predictive model of the CPI, because, you know, obviously, we have a good interest in trying to figure out if we do see consumer prices rising, is it going to last? Is it going to go on forever? Is there any sort of secular trend there? And so these academic models take a look at the CPI as if every CPI is exactly the same. And so their conclusions are usually about what is the best predictor of the CPI? And I don't think that's really the right question to ask because, again, there are different types of situations where consumer prices could be reacting or be responsible from other different factors, very different factors that lead to very different conclusions and all sorts of different implications. So if we get into the slides here, yeah, that's really our goal here. Let's start on slide 3 is we look at the CPI, we look at consumer prices, and what we're really interested in is it just consumer prices rising? Or is there an inflation? Is there inflation responsible for why consumer prices are going up? And what the academic economist, you know, mainstream orthodoxy tells you is that there really isn't a good way to sort out predictive CPI values. It's really pretty much a crapshoot. They figure the best methods is by using professional economists who use econometric models, you know, things like the Blue Chip Economic Survey, because they have at least a decent track record of predicting the CPI. And you look at some of the other factors they looked at, you know, some of the other ways of predicting consumer prices. Among the worst, they say, is financial markets or bond yields, which is kind of what we're trying to get at here, which is, do bond yields predict the CPI or do bond yields react only to inflation in these CPIs? And so that's really where we're going to start. If we go to slide 4, throughout history, consumer prices have been driven by very different factors at very different times. We're very much familiar with the 1970s and the great inflation. And so we're kind of led to believe that anytime the CPI accelerates, it's because of inflation. As you said before, printing too much money, currency devaluation, that kind of thing. But in truth, you have to go back to before 1955. But usually when the CPIs went up, it had nothing to do with monetary printing. It had nothing to do with money printing or excess currency. And a perfect example of that is 1950-51. We had what was essentially a classic supply shock, which was, you know, the North Koreans invaded South Korea June 24th of 1950. Within a couple weeks, American consumers went to every store they could find and started buying everything imaginable because they understood that pretty soon the U.S. government was going to start redirecting economic resources into the war fighting effort when the U.S. finally joined the Korean conflict. And so it was very much like World War II, where consumers understood that the availability of goods was going to be restricted. And so it created this massive bottleneck where consumers went absolutely nuts buying everything they could possibly buy while it was still available. At the same time, the supply side was not able to keep up with that demand because, number one, it was a true shock in the fact that it was unpredictable. But also, as more and more resources were taking away from the consumer sector and channeled into the defense industries, it was, again, supply just could not keep up with demand. And so in terms of small E economic prices, from around July 1950 to February 1951, the consumer price index accelerated to, at that time, which was an annual rate of more than 12%. So it wasn't money printing. It wasn't, you know, currency devaluation, even though the Federal Reserve was convinced that it was. And the Federal Reserve actually provoked a political crisis to gain its independence from the Treasury Department, because those at the Fed were absolutely concerned this rise in consumer prices was inflationary. Therefore, it was going to continue unless they were able to gain independent monetary policy. But they got the inflation thing wrong. They didn't look at the CPI as a supply shock. And this, and the level of CPI puts what we're seeing today to shame. Because again, the annual rate of 12%, that was a massive burst of consumer price inflation, but it wasn't really inflation. It was actually just a supply shock.
Okay. Hang on a second, Jeff, because you're making this distinction. You're saying it's not really inflation in the sense of, okay, technically it's not monetary inflation. Something else was driving that extraordinary increase in consumer prices that you agree did happen starting in 1950-51. That did happen. You're just saying it wasn't monetary inflation. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's what we're trying to get at. There's
okay, but here's what I'm hearing. I sounds to me like you're arguing my side of this, because what I see is, okay, so maybe it's not monetary inflation, but what I see is we just had a global pandemic which caused this crazy event that wiped out a whole lot of the U.S. shale production capability. We now have an ESG trend which says that we're going to vilify extractive industries, whether that makes any logical sense or not. We're going to punish them by not investing in them. So we're not doing any investment in new oil production resources. So all of those things add up, Jeff, to say, in my mind, we've got huge increases in energy prices on the near horizon coming our way. That would be a factor that has nothing to do with money printing, but has everything to do with consumer prices going to the moon in the near future. And at the same time, we have, for now at least, the Democrats control the White House and the Congress. I just had a listener point out to me over the weekend that, you know, probably in 2022, the Democrats will lose control of the Congress. So that'll change things a little bit. But still, all of this MMT stuff is super popular. Lots and lots of politicians want to print more money, and particularly they want to get it out to Main Street, not to Wall Street. These all sound like we're putting more money in consumers' pockets to drive prices up. And you're right, it has nothing to do with money printing and currency devaluation. But I think that those factors are very much in play to set up a great big secular inflation.
Look, I agree with you, Eric, that, you know, like, again, when I say it's not inflation, I'm not saying consumer prices haven't gone up, and they might not continue to go up a little bit further. What I'm saying was without the monetary component, without actually being true inflation, and I hate using that term, but inflation is a monetary phenomenon, as we'll get to. Without that monetary component, excess currency, if you want to do quantity theory, what happens is you have a sharp spike in prices for other non-economic reasons, as you just described. But then the economy is forced to adjust to it. In other words, we're robbing other parts of the economy by having to pay higher prices at the pump, for example. And eventually, that's where the inflationary trend always breaks down, as it did in 1950-51. Once the consumer stopped buying all those goods, inflation stopped because it wasn't really inflation. And if we're going to be paying $200 a barrel for oil, that's going to rob consumers of so much discretionary power that other parts of the economy are going to suffer in a deflationary way that is going to balance out what's going on in oil prices. So it's not going to be a secular inflation trend, because it can't be a secular inflation trend without the monetary component. And if you fast forward to what I'm getting at here in the slide deck to we'll go to slide 5 now. You know, again, there's a difference when it comes to inflation versus this other stuff, these non-economic factors. And really, you know, even as the BLS pointed out not too long ago, inflation behaved very differently from around 1955 forward until around 2007, simply because there was the monetary system behind it that allowed inflation to react very differently than it had previous to 1955, as I'm showing in the 1950 example, which is that consumer prices tend to lump together in these supply shock spikes that never lasted because there was no monetary component. And the best way we can sort out between these various versions of consumer price index increases, what's inflation and what's from other non-economic factors, is simply by using the bond market and bond yields. So if you go to slide 6, As you can see, before 1955, the bond yields stayed very low, which was consistent with the deflationary aftermath of the Great Depression, because we got to remember our interest rate fallacy. Low yields denote tight money, not loose money. And so low yields before 1955 were a signal that despite three massive shocks in the CPI, three huge double-digit increases in consumer prices, they were only ever concentrated into temporary, short, transitory periods of time because they were not real inflation. They were simply supply shocks that when they ran their course, consumer prices then returned to the baseline, which, judging by bond yields, these were, you know, non-monetary inflation, not money inflation. So it's not real inflation. That all changed around 1955. This Eurodollar system got introduced in various ways, and it started to leak back into the domestic United States system. And look what happened. Lo and behold, the bond market sniffed out the inflation before it ever showed up. And if you go to slide 7, you can see that bond yields were starting to rise years before the great inflation, the actual great inflation start, which the great inflation, I think pretty much everybody knows nowadays, was a monetary event. It was exactly the classic case of too much money chasing too few goods. And bond yields were absolutely spot on throughout that first, not just the initial period, but if you go to slide 8, you can also see how bond yields predicted the ups and downs during the great inflation themselves. And what's interesting is not only are bond yields at least, you know, months ahead, if not years ahead of actual monetary inflation. Again, in 1973, we had the oil price shock with the OPEC embargo, which bond yields correctly saw as that's another supply shock that's being piled upon this underlying monetary inflation that had already driven yields upward and already driven CPI upward in a sustained manner. So what the bond market is telling you through this first half and in the second half of the great inflation is that it is a very useful tool for sorting out what is the money supply problem, the real inflation versus what is these non-economic factors. And if they're non-economic, again, what are long-term bond yields all about? As Irving Fisher said more than a century ago, long-term bond yields are growth in inflation expectations. So even if there's a secular non-economic reason behind consumer prices, then long-term bond yields would see that somehow as, okay, that's something I got to factor. If I'm owning a 10-year U.S. Treasury and I expect non-economic consumer prices to be accelerated, some secular trend to continue for 10 years, then I've got to factor that into how I'm viewing my holdings of U.S. Treasuries. So if the Treasury market says whatever's going on in the CPI is not going to affect the long run, then the bond market is essentially discounting these different factors, which lead to this ability to sort out different CPIs from one from the other. Is it monetary? Is it actual inflation? Or is it something else that isn't going to last, that isn't going to impact the long run? I think people can probably understand where we're going with this. We flash forward to slide 9, we're getting into the 21st century. And again, the bond market has done a very good, if not perfect, job of sorting out which CPIs represent monetary inflation, and which are just transitory supply shocks or transitory shocks for other factors.
Okay, Jeff, I just want to get this straight, because it sounds to me, if I plan to have you back on this program 1 year from today, like we've kind of got a setup where I might say, Jeff, you said there was going to be no inflation, but now gasoline prices are $7.23 a gallon. And you might say, yeah, but that wasn't inflation. I mean, is that where we're headed?
And it sounds like a cop-out, doesn't it? But yeah, you're right. That's what we're saying is, the bond market has looked at the 2021 CPI spike and says, this is not money printing. This is not inflation. This is something else. And you're saying that this something, you're agreeing with me, right, Eric? You're saying that I agree. This is not money printing. This is not.
This is not strict monetary inflation, but I still think that an energy-led price shock is coming, which is going to dramatically increase first energy prices, and then almost everything else has energy as an input cost. So the price of everything else goes up. That results in even more unhappiness with lower income consumers particularly, and it leads, I think, at that point to money printing, real monetary inflation, as a government response. The way they respond to people can't afford that $7 gasoline is they print up a bunch of money and give it out as handouts or transfer payments of some kind to support the economy. And if you listen to what Joe Biden said about inflation, he said, listen, don't worry about it because we're going to pump so much money into this economy, it's not going to matter. And everybody who understands inflation rolled their eyes and said, oh my God, I can't believe he said that.
Well, they but don't understand him, inflation. That's the point. Well,
take him at face value. What he's saying is what they're going to do in response to inflation, what they're going to do in response to consumer price increases, particularly around energy, is they're going to generate real inflation. They're going to print up a whole bunch of money, and you're going to get the inflation that you're saying is not coming.
The bond market says it's not happening. In fact, the bond market is unequivocal about how such a low probability that it is, it's not even worth paying much attention to. I just went through more than 75 years of history, and it goes back further. We got over a century of history where the bond market has been spot on, time and again, sorting about long-run consumer price changes. What is inflation? What is not inflation? What is the non-economic factors we need to pay attention to over the intermediate and long run, and which ones we don't? And right now, the bond market is unequivocal, saying, yeah, Biden may say these things, but it's not going to happen. And there's a very specific reason it's not going to happen. If we go to slide 10, as Milton Friedman said in 1963 as he was touring India, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon. Now, he didn't make this statement as sort of I'm just conjecturing here, or this is a theory I had that I'm bouncing around in my head. He made this statement, he just wrote A Monetary History. So he made this statement as an acknowledgement of empirical fact and reality. So inflation is everywhere a monetary phenomenon. In nearly 60 years since he said that, everything is only validated what he was saying, especially the later 60s and 70s of the great inflation. That, look, we know what inflation is. Inflation is money, and inflation means long-run problems. And if it's a long-run problem, the bond market is going to find out about it, and it's going to trade upon it. And if the bond market says there is no long-run inflation here, there is no money printing, then that's a pretty good historically validated gauge that says no matter what's going on in the short run, we're going to shrug our shoulders and ignore it because there are other problems that supersede what's going on. And as I said before, yes, we can have gasoline prices become extraordinarily expensive and painful, but all that's going to do in the absence of money printing and currency devaluation, all that's going to do is create other economic problems in other parts of the economy that are going to balance it out so that these so-called secular trends never become secular in the first place. Again, this is the judgment of the bond market. It's not me saying this. I'm just telling you what bond yields are saying. And again, this has been a reliable, historically validated, empirically established indicator, which right now is saying, yeah, we hear all of the stuff that you're talking about. We see oil prices going up. We see the CPI at 6.2% and used car prices being 1/8 of the increase in the October CPI. But that's not inflation. And inflation is what we have to look at over the long run, not the short run.
Okay, Jeff. So we're still in agreement that there is a good chance that energy prices in particular go to the moon from here, but it's not inflation. And then that gets transmitted into the rest of consumer prices going up dramatically, but it's not inflation.
No, and that's not what I'm saying at all.
wait a minute. But I mean, it sounds what you're saying. It sounds like that's what you're saying. And then what I'm saying in reaction to that is the president of the United States went on television and already announced his intention of how he's going to respond to inflation is by throwing money at it. So that says to me, they're going to print money.
No, they're not going to print money. They don't know how. And again, we've heard all this stuff before. It's just the numbers have gotten bigger. I mean, we're having the same arguments we had in 2009 and 2010. It's really just the same thing. And the reason the bond market skepticism is because it's been empirically validated time and time again. Yeah, who cares what Joe Biden has to say? He doesn't control money. That's really the whole point here is that inflation is all about money. And I'm not saying energy prices will go to the moon. I'm saying energy prices can be temporarily elevated in extremely painful ways. But that pain that consumers will feel because of rising gasoline prices will rob other parts of the economy of vitality and economic activity such that you'll have one sector of the economy that's nominally growing massively because of inflation and prices, because prices are going up, but that is going to depress other parts of the economy. And over time, neither the energy trend nor the economic trend can survive that kind of split personality. You can't have rising energy prices and have economic growth continue for very long because, again, history has shown what happens in those situations is you end up with a really nasty recession or contraction within very short order. And that necessary recession and contraction, as nasty as it gets, reestablishes a very different price, consumer price environment, which is not inflationary. In fact, it ends up being deflationary. Consumer prices, including those of energy and gasoline, will fall very quickly when we get into that sort of a situation. So if energy prices continue to go as they are now, absent the money printing, which is not there, I don't care what Joe Biden has to say, the market says unequivocally, the guy has no clue. Just like Jay Powell has no clue, and just like economists don't have any idea what goes on in the monetary system, the bond market is telling you unequivocally that no matter how high energy prices get in the short run, it's not going to stick around for the long run because it just cannot. It's not actual inflation. It's a temporary trend that's based upon, as you said, supply factors and supply shock factors alone. And because of that, it's not an economy-wide, it's not a global situation that's going to last for very long because it can't. Without the money printing, you can't get it. Again, Milton Friedman in 1963, this was not, you know, conjecture. It was empirically based. And the best way we have of telling us what is going on in the monetary system, what is going on in the real economy, not just today, but what is the best type of information or best real-time argument that we can make about what the future is likely to look like when, you know, the 10-year treasury is now, what, 1.6%, even though it's up over the last couple of weeks? I mean, that is an incredibly low rate. And I haven't even got to real yields yet, which are unbelievably ugly. So what the bond market is saying, this is not me, this is the bond market is saying, and bond market, by the way, that's the people who actually do the money in the global euro dollar system. So they're already telling you the money's not there. The money's not going to be there at any real probability for the future. And so this isn't inflation. This is just like the pre-1955 supply shocks where once they run their course, they will run their course and the CPI will eventually go back down and our energy prices will eventually go back down. Whether or not that's triggered by a recession or not, that remains to be seen. But we're already seeing some signs that that's the case. You know, this global growth scare that's emerging even in the mainstream narrative, we're seeing a lot of these, you know, transitory effects as transitory because without the money printing, it just won't last. And that's really, you know, moving forward in the slide deck here, from 13, you know, to 14, to 15 and 16, 17 and beyond, what I'm showing people is that what is the monetary system saying? What is it looking at? And the theme this year has been, as you point out, Eric, it's been inflation, inflation, inflation. And for people to pay attention to the Federal Reserve or even broadly monetary conditions, it's been too much money, too much money, too much money, whether it's bank reserves, the reverse repo, any number of things. And yet, when you look at these indications, not just the bond yields, and it's not just U.S. Treasuries either. These are bond yields all over the world. But we have tick data. We have Chinese data. We have all sorts of data that tells us that it's not inflationary money in 2021. It's the opposite. We have deflationary conditions rising throughout this year, which eventually lead into some sort of downturn, if not global recession, which will end any secular price trend in energy and everything else real quickly. So the entire monetary system and the markets that trade off them, again, they're unequivocal in saying that whatever's happening in the consumer prices right now is not going to last. It can't last.
Jeff, I have to comment on slide number 14 because, boy, every doomsday blogger on the internet back around 2009, 10, 11, 12 was writing the same story, which is you better watch out because what's coming is foreign holders of U.S. Treasuries are going to divest their U.S. Treasury holdings. When that happens, it is going to outright crash the U.S. Treasury market. We're going to have hyperinflation, my favorite word that people love to misuse, of the U.S. dollar. It's coming as soon as those foreigners divest their treasury holdings. Well, guess what? As you show in this chart, they were exactly right that foreigners were going to divest their treasury holdings wholesale, just outright.
They dumped them.
And there's no hyperinflation, and I don't think that the phenomenon that we're seeing right now is a result of that. What happened there, and what does it mean? Why didn't the dumping of foreign holdings of U.S. treasuries cause a crash in the bond market back when you saw this activity happening? And now we're getting some inflation at a time when it looks like foreigners are actually starting to reinvest at least slightly in the treasury market. It seems backwards.
It is backwards, and it's a fundamental misconception of how the global monetary system works. And again, it's understandable why people would say this and at least start to think about it because it sounds intuitive, right? And if we've been told for years that without foreign buying of U.S. Treasury specifically, but also U.S. dollars more broadly, that those markets would be toast. They would be without the foreign demand for treasuries. Screw it. The treasuries are going to be worthless because we need foreigners because of people's theories on capital accounts and things like that. But in the eurodollar system, as you can see clearly on the chart here, what actually happens in reality is that when there's more dollars in this offshore monetary system flowing all the way out, you know, through the vast corners of the global system, what happens is they end up in official hands, either central bankers or finance ministries. And those central bankers and finance ministries, they like to create a pile of reserves, which they think are some form of insurance against a dollar short. In 1997, 98, you know, Asian financial crisis type situation. And they like to invest those dollars in low risk, high liquidity assets like U.S. treasuries. So those things are always related. More dollars flowing in the eurodollar system, more dollars end up in official, foreign official hands, more dollars again end up being reinvested by these foreign officials in U.S. treasuries in particular, also agency and GSE debt as well. So around, as you can see, you know, foreigners tend to have problems when there's dollar problems in the global eurodollar system. That started in August of 2007 and continued to 2008, which was nothing more than a global dollar shortage. And if you have a global dollar shortage, obviously there's fewer dollars flowing through these foreign central banks, which means they can't buy as many treasuries as they might have beforehand. And so in the rare and more extreme situations of a dollar shortage, these foreign reserve managers actually have to sell their treasuries to try to make up their dollar shortfall that the eurodollar market isn't doing. That we have tightness in the eurodollar market that causes problems for local banks, and central banks sell their, they liquidate their reserve assets to try to supply dollars temporarily into the market. And so by the time we get to 2014, the global dollar shortage from the global financial crisis proved to be a series of crises, a series of shortages, not a one-off and limited to 2008, 2009. But 2014 was a particularly bad one that especially hit emerging markets like China. And the Chinese and other foreign countries decided they needed to react to this growing dollar tightness by selling their U.S. Treasury. It wasn't because they hated Treasury. It wasn't because they hated the dollar. It wasn't because they hated the Federal Reserve's printing money. In fact, they were reacting to the opposite of money printing. They were reacting to tight money. So whenever you see foreigners, particularly central banks and foreign officials institutions selling treasuries, what that means is that there's a tightness of dollar funding outside the United States, as well as inside, but mostly outside the United States. So it's a very good signal of tight money. And what you can see in 2020 and 2021 is that, yeah, we had a little bit of reflation up until around April of this year. And ever since then, it's been going the opposite way. So we've had tightening in the eurodollar system, which has led to, again, a little bit of renewed selling. But, you know, once the selling starts, it becomes difficult to stop. So it's falling U.S. treasuries or selling treasuries. It's not, you know, it's not a negative for the treasury market. It's a negative for the monetary. It's a negative sign for the monetary system. And as you can see, those things go together. Because what have treasury prices done since 2014? Just like the dollar's exchange value, both have gone up dramatically because we're talking about deflationary money embedded within all of those processes.
Okay, so let's talk about what you think is going to happen, because it sounds like what you're saying is you agree with me and Ola Hansen that the lack of investment in producing oil resources is likely to lead to a oil price or energy price shock, which will probably be transmitted into a broader consumer price shock. But you're saying, okay, that's not monetary inflation, and it's going to result in, essentially, it sounds like it'll bring on a recession, which is deflationary, and everything corrects. Is that what happens, or what happens from there?
Yeah, I think the energy prices make a bad situation that's already bad, makes it that much worse and more painful. Because again, you know, consumers are paying more at the pump, and they're doing so. It's not like their wages or their pay is rising to match the prices that they're paying. And not just it's not just, you know, obviously gasoline or energy prices. We see it in all sorts of supply shock driven markets, just for regular consumer goods, for example. You know, automobiles, another perfect example, which, you know, I have a couple of slides for that. But yeah, that's what the market judgment is saying. We have, on the one hand, not only do we not have the money printing that makes it in monetary inflation or inflation going forward, we actually have the opposite trend starting to develop, which is deflationary or tightness in the monetary system. We see this in any number of indications, data, and markets, including, by the way, inflation expectations in the TIPS market. If you go to slide 18, slide 17, you see the rising dollar. Rising dollar is always a negative sign. That's always a sign of tight money, just as it was in 2018 when the Reserve Bank of India's Governor Urjit Patel got to, you know, saw funding dry up in the dollar market so badly, while everybody was convinced that was going to be an inflationary period. He's saying, wait the hell, you know, out here in the rest of the emerging markets, dollar funding has evaporated. That, so rising dollar, you equate with tightness in money, as you would some things that are going on in the Chinese People's Bank of China's balance sheet, which are, you know, dollar deposits that are being demanded from their local banks. And even in just, you know, TIPS market, we see a surge in short run inflation expectations, but yet the TIPS curve or the inflation break even curve itself is upside down. And lately it's upside down in absolutely record fashion, which is the market saying short run CPI, long run less CPI, which you get to slide 19, which is longer run inflation expectations, the five-year forward rate. And you can see even today, even as short run inflation break-evens in the TIPS market are through the roof, long run inflation expectations remain in that same post-2014 state that, like officials selling their U.S. treasuries, is more deflationary or disinflationary than it is inflationary. So every part of the treasury market, as well as the global bond market, is uniformly saying this is not inflation. And whatever's happening in terms of the CPI, it's not going to last very long. And you know, that's a term of art. And you're right to, you know, that's sort of a cop-out too, Eric, because you say, well, it's not going to last very long. And the question immediately is, well, how long is it going to last? If you're saying it's temporary or transitory, how long might it last? And the thing is, we don't really know, but the market is almost positive. It's unequivocal that it's not going to last. And, you know, historically speaking, some of these supply shocks can go on for a year or more.
Jeff, as I look through the next few slides in the deck, I see that you're saying a lot of the same things that I'm saying in terms of there are factors, which you're right, they're not technically monetary inflation per se, but I think there's going to be an energy price-led consumer price increase, and it's going to result in a broader, you know, the cost of energy is an input cost to almost everything. So broader cost of everything from shipping to widgets to, you know, office supplies is going to go up. And I see all of that coming. You're saying that technically that's not being driven by monetary inflation, but I'd like to challenge your conclusion that what it leads to is, okay, you said people's wages are not going up, so it's going to end up being deflationary because the economy can't afford it and those high energy prices cripple everything. Well, let's try a thought experiment. What if we take the President of the United States at his word? He says he's going to throw money at the problem of inflation, which is not usually what most textbooks tell you you do with inflation, but I think we should take him at his word. Suppose that what they do is they say, look, we got to let inflation run hot because we've got to do something to devalue the real purchasing power of the national debt. We've got to get the national debt under control. The way to do that is to inflate it away. If we inflate it away, it's going to damage the lower end income people in society the most. So, hey, let's use this new MMT stuff and just print up a shitload of money and hand it out and say, look, yeah, we're going to let inflation run hot and we'll identify some boogeyman overseas who doesn't look like us. Hey, OPEC Plus, it must be their fault. And let's blame the Russians too, because, you know, Russians, they're to blame for everything.
And the Chinese.
We're going to blame. And it's, well, yeah, that's right.
Got to get the Chinese in there.
It's those stinking Chinese and their stockpiling of oil. That's got to be part of this. Yep. And the stinking Russians and those OPEC, those Arabs. Ooh, bad guys. Okay, we've got lots of boogeymen. We've got lots of people to scapegoat and blame. And what we're going to do is say the Biden administration has got your back. We're going to take care of hardworking Americans by printing more money and exacerbating it. Maybe it wasn't monetary inflation when it started, Jeff, but I have complete confidence in the people in Washington, D.C., to respond to this by saying, we're going to print up enough money to turn it into monetary inflation. And what we're going to do is a whole bunch of transfer payments and handouts in order to buy off the populace so that they don't, you know, blame us for this. We'll blame the monetary inflation for people who have savings that are losing the value of their savings. We'll blame it on foreigners who don't look like us. There's plenty of those to choose from. And we'll just print money like it's going out of style with MMT in order to basically provide government transfer payments in order to solve that problem. It doesn't lead to a deflationary result. And that's where you get to, I think, potentially not only secular inflation, but maybe even the beginnings of runaway inflation. Not quite hyperinflation, but it could really start to run away to the point where they can't control it. That's what I see on the horizon. What's wrong with that theory?
Well, again, I go back to the bond market. The bond market hears and has discounted everything that you've just said, because the bond market isn't some kind of, you know, some centralized person, some enlightened philosopher in a room staring at computer screens and listening to chats and things like that. The bond market is everywhere in everything. It's essentially a broad-based information system, sort of like big data, that is situated very close to the real economy. It actually is the big banks who run the monetary system as it is currently constituted. And it has looked at your situation, looked at your scenario, and it is pricing it as essentially a 0% chance of happening. Well, you never say never. So maybe it's a, you know, 0.1% chance of happening. But as I said in earlier, we have this information stream, this information sorting mechanism that tells you something very specific about the future. It looks at the long run, the same long run that you're looking at, Eric, using the same information that you're using, and the same and pricing these, you know, hypothetically pricing these scenarios in the same way that you are. And it's saying it's not a realistic chance. The money isn't there.
Wait a minute. Why is the bond market saying that? Why is it not that the bond market is saying, well, yeah, all that stuff I just described could happen. But as part of that, the Federal Reserve is going to continue printing money to also buy bonds in order to keep interest rates.
The Fed doesn't print money. You know. It gets back to, do we understand what actually printing money means? Because I don't think people do.
Okay, let's not get hung up. Let's assume that there is another big round of quantitative easing so that we're creating bank reserves, and that is depressing the long-term interest rates and keeping those bond yields down. It's suppressing.
That is not happening, and that has never happened. Bond yields react most of the time opposite of quantitative easing. Eric, you got to just look at a bond yield chart, and it shows you that when the Fed is buying bonds, interest rates tend to rise, not fall. And when the Fed stops buying bonds, and it's not just the Fed, you can look at the ECB. Look at German bond yields in 2018 and 2019. German bond yields were falling as Mario Draghi stopped buying German bonds. They kept going down. The Fed does not control the interest rate, and the Federal Reserve nor any central bank is controlling any interest rates right now. They are not artificially depressing the bond market. That's not how this works. And you could even ask the central bankers themselves, read the literature on quantitative easing. It's all uniformly says bond market sets the interest rate and the yields on the in the real economy. And yields, as we all know, are about growth and inflation. So you can't just wave your hand to dismiss these low yields as some kind of artificial signal that the Fed wants to send, that it's artificially depressing yields. That's just not happening. And it hasn't happened. The bond market is independently assessing growth and inflation opportunities as it has since there's ever been a bond market. And it's saying, we see all of these things and we agree in uniform that we don't see consumer prices breaking out on some secular trend for reasons of money or not money.
Okay, so your argument is basically the bond market is essentially always right or almost always right. And how accurate does the history, in your estimation, prove that out?
As I just went through in the entire first half of the presentation, it's pretty damn accurate. You know, the bond yields started rising in anticipation of the great inflation. So if we're moving into a second grade inflation and bond yields are not moving and anticipating a second grade inflation, why not? What has changed? And you can't answer the Federal Reserve because that's lazy analysis, Eric. You haven't even looked. All you need to do is look at a yield chart and to know that the Federal Reserve does not have much of an impact on yields. It's exclusively growth and inflation expectations that are being set in the market. And as I said before, the market is not some narrow clique that has, you know, that's trying to price some political agenda. It is a very broad-based global monetary system. It's the market that trades closest to the global monetary system that tells you what's going on in terms of money, what's going on in terms of the real economy, and what's really what everybody thinks is going to be happening in this marketplace for the foreseeable future. Now, it's not perfect. It's not a crystal ball, but historically speaking, over the last century and more, it has been the best, most useful, most accurate tool for assessing inflation potential. Not CPIs, but inflation potential. And that's what we're really talking about here. And so, yeah, the bond market's judgment right now is that for the last year or so that we've been hearing about all this stuff, for the last year that we've seen the supply shock develop, and for now that we have the 6.2% CPI, that's the highest in 30 years, the judgment hasn't changed. The bond market still says this is non-economic stuff. It's painful. It's causing enough pain on top of a bad deflationary situation that is likely to result in an adjustment in the real economy that nets out over time to not inflation.
Okay, so to summarize, you're saying that you do agree that a significant increase in consumer prices led by energy is very possible, but because the bond market is telling us that it is not anticipating that turning into monetary inflation, you think that Janet is essentially right, that it is transitory, it's going to happen, it's, you know, we're going to see that big energy-led increase in prices, but it's not inflation, and it's all going to reverse because it's going to lead to pressure on the economy that takes us the other direction.
Yeah, and I love how you framed it that way, putting me on the same side as Janet Yellen.
I guess that was pretty evil.
Yeah, I know. Well, you had to smile a little bit when you did that. No, it makes me tremendously uncomfortable to be, you know, to say I agree with Jay Powell and Janet Yellen, but you know, they might be right for the wrong reasons, but yeah. And again,
okay, we got a title for this episode, Jeff Snyder.
No,
I agree with Janet Yellen Jay Powell.
Clickbait. No. No, but it's sad but true. And I think, you know, she's right for the wrong reasons. And your summarization is correct. I think we have these supply factors. We have a classic supply shock that's developed, and it's especially over the last couple of months, it's becoming extremely painful, and it becomes more painful by the day and by the week, and that eventually, without the money printing, without actual money in the economy, in fact, we have deflationary money in the global economy, that's why the bond yields are so low. It's not the Fed. It's the fact that the bond market is saying, you know, again, broad survey of actual real-time economic conditions that whatever happens in energy markets, it's not going to lead to runaway secular inflation.
Jeff, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to touch on a few of the other things that our listeners can do to follow your work. The first, if you haven't done it already, is definitely listen to Eurodollar University, which is several hours, I've forgotten how many, of Jeff's analysis and explanation of how the offshore wholesale U.S. dollar funding system really works. And I've got to say, in all of the interviews that I've done on Macro Voices over the years, we've got a lot of opinions, a lot of viewpoints, and there's always somebody coming back saying, oh, that guy doesn't know what he's talking about. Ola Hansen doesn't know what he's talking about. David Hay doesn't know what he's talking about. And usually people come back and say, Jeff Snyder, that guy's over my head. I'm not sure what he's talking about. So I haven't heard the argument that says Jeff's wrong. I've just heard the we don't know what he's talking about. And I think Eurodollar University is a great place to start. But also, tell us a little bit more. You and our good friend Emil Kalinowski are producing your own podcast. What's that about, and where can people follow it?
It's really an extension of what you and I started out doing, Eric, which is Eurodollar University, trying to explain the monetary system. And yeah, we have our own podcast that you can find on YouTube. It's called Eurodollar University's Making Sense, where we try to make sense of money printing, CPIs, bond yields, and all, you know, Federal Reserve policy and all these other things. Again, you can find it on YouTube. You can find it on wherever you get your podcast downloads too.
And that all builds on the work that we did at macrovoices.com/EDU, which is probably the very first place to start. And also, of course, you guys manage money at Alhambra Investments. You can find information about that at alhambrapartners.com. Jeff, I can't thank you enough. Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. Escrow.com is the payment system for buying and selling anything of value. Cars, boats, airplanes, jewelry, gemstones, fine art, collectibles, intellectual property rights, domain names, bringing in shipping containers from overseas, or even buying and selling entire businesses. It's simple to use. Either party sets up the transaction, then the buyer sends the funds to Escrow.com. The seller is then instructed to send the goods to the buyer to inspect. Within the inspection period, the buyer can return the items for any reason. After that, Escrow.com pays the seller immediately. Escrow.com is the world's most secure payment system from a counterparty risk perspective because the funds sit in escrow. Over 2 million customers have transacted over $5 billion on Escrow.com, and eBay and Shopify use it for cars, boats, luxury watches, and business sales. It's available in the United States, Canada, and Australian dollars, euros, and British pounds. Never buy or sell anything online unless you use Escrow.com. escrow.com. Escrow.com is a subsidiary of freelancer.com, listed on the OTCQX Best Markets under the ticker symbol FLNCF and the Australian Securities Exchange under the ticker FLN.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Jeff back on the show. And, you know, it really did get my hamster wheel turning because really this inflation has been truly supply shock driven and these commodities running higher are sprinkling higher prices everywhere. But he does make very valid points in terms of the fact that there isn't really the monetary drivers behind it that are going to suggest that this is anything more than a supply shock. I mean, at least it's an interesting argument to consider. What did you take away from it?
Well, I still see very strong arguments in favor of secular inflation. And as I described, I think the political backdrop is just set up for governments to respond with, more stimulus, more largesse, and I think driving more money into the economy and driving prices higher. I think the strongest reaction I had to this interview is it really makes me want to do a little bit of homework and due diligence because Jeff is a very detail-oriented guy who, in my experience, knows his stuff. Now, he's making an argument that there has never been a significant inflation that was not preceded by long bond yields predicting it. And he showed that fantastic chart, which told us that even though everybody thinks that August 15th, 1971, when President Nixon took us off the gold standard, was an unforeseeable event that brought on the great inflation and nobody could have known it was coming, in actuality, the bond market predicted it years in advance. Is Jeff's research completely solid, and is it really true that the bond market always forecasts and predicts significant inflations? If that's really true, then boy, his argument is hard to argue. I feel like maybe some of our listeners know better than I do, or some of the other folks that we've had on as feature interview guests who have argued for secular inflation, which is certainly still my view, have done their homework and know better than I do, because I can't argue with Jeff. He's got better data than I have, and his graphs and charts are much more detailed than my personal research. I would love to hear the counterargument from somebody who's ready to explain specifically why it is that Jeff has it wrong when he says the bond market has always anticipated and predicted significant inflations. If Jeff has that wrong, I'd love to know who can prove that, and maybe we can get them on the show. But right now, Patrick, I want to move on to the post-game chart deck, which is titled, Can the Trends Continue? Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you haven't yet subscribed at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, click the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, what do we have going on here with the euro? You usually start your chart decks with the S&P. How come we're looking at the euro-dollar cross this week?
Because I wanted to basket all the equities together, and so we'll look at that a little bit further into the chart deck. But I still do want to talk the S&P, and there's some interesting stuff to point out about it. But anyway, let's talk the euro. And I just really want to highlight that the U.S. dollar has literally been in a very predominant new breakout on the upside, but it's been very much driven by a breakdown in the euro. This has been it's not only the largest component of the dollar index from a trade weighted basis, but it's also been one of the weakest currencies by far. We've entered a zone around 113 where there's some fib zones, some previous highs, lows, a level where arguably the euro could muster up a reaction. And what one of the key things I'm going to be watching is when we do get this bounce, we already started a bit of a bounce, can the euro bulls muster up something more than a 100 pip reaction? If all we get is a quick bounce back to 114, 115 that is stalling out, it'll be interesting to see whether the trend continues on the downside of the euro. And that's certainly something I'm watching. All right. So, Eric, though, I wanted to move on to page 3, where I have that crude oil chart. And so we can really see that after a really amazing run through September into early October, where crude oil tacked on close to $25 on the upside, we've really retested the highs and started to break down in this correction. There's some fib zones that suggest that we could go into the mid-70s during a correction. At least I'm siding with the idea that this is still going to be a buy on dip. I look at that correction and compare a lot to the consolidations we saw both in March and through July and August, which is the market just pauses, takes a period to backfill some of the rally, and then just resumes in bullish manner. At least that's my starting base case. What's your call on this? And also, you wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on in the oil markets.
Well, Patrick, as I said in the market wrap, I think that this is definitely a buy the dip opportunity that is upcoming. Maybe this morning on Thursday morning was a bottom. It did touch the 55-day moving average, and actually going back more than a year now to November of 2020, that 55-day moving average has pretty much held the market up. So there is an argument that this is already over. The thing is, the Biden administration, with all of its rhetoric around energy prices, has, I think, itself into a political corner where it has little choice but to, quote, do something about energy prices. The thing is, there's not much that the Biden administration can do about energy prices. The widely circulated rumor is that President Biden was supposedly almost pleading with President Xi in China about asking President Xi to participate with a coordinated, it sounds like maybe the Biden administration was trying to architect a global coordinated strategic petroleum reserve release where they could somehow organize all the world leaders to agree that it was time to release from their strategic petroleum reserves in order to bring prices down. Now, it's tempting to say that no world leader other than Joe Biden could possibly be stupid enough to think that an SPR release is the right way to address this problem. But it does appear that President Biden is having some success with persuading other world leaders, at least, and it makes me wonder what it is that President Biden offered in return in exchange for these favors. But China did announce just today that a release from its strategic reserve is in the works, although that announcement seems a little bit vague to me, and it makes me wonder if other world leaders are being pressured to cooperate with President Biden with a token or symbolic release, which I doubt is going to be very substantial, but this information is just coming out as we're going to airtime here. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of days. But the Biden administration is clearly going to try to do what they can to persuade other world leaders to participate in what I think is virtue signaling nonsense that has nothing to do with real long-term supply and demand fundamentals, but what clearly could impact the market in coming days and weeks ahead. So it'll be interesting to see how this develops. So the next question is, what can the Biden administration do with just a U.S. SPR release? And again, the SPR, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, was created after the 1973 oil embargo, and its purpose is to protect national security. If there was an import embargo or some other issue that affected the ability of the United States to continue to function without imported oil, there's basically a buffer that is intended to protect us there. That Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the language around it is pretty darn clear that it's there for a bunch of purposes that have nothing to do with bailing the Biden administration out of high energy prices due to policies that, frankly, were created by the Biden administration. So it's not what it's there for, but the thing is, the way that the law is worded, the government has the authority to sell up to 30 million barrels if the president believes that the current situation might lead to an emergency, and they can sell an unlimited amount of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve if an actual emergency exists. The thing is, what defines when an actual emergency exists? The language of that law is pretty darn clear. It's whenever the president says so. So as soon as President Biden is willing to use the word emergency to describe the situation, he's allowed to do whatever the hell he wants. And I think that the potential for him to do something foolish, which both undermines national security and doesn't actually achieve the intended goal, and potentially sets up a situation where you end up with exacerbating the problem because of the SPR release and the ultimate need to later resupply the SPR, I think it's all a whole bunch of bad politics in play. But I also think that there is really not a lot of limitation preventing the Biden administration from doing something very foolish, which could shock prices to the downside. As people say, oh my gosh, the Biden administration just sold, you know, whatever it is, 100 million barrels out of the SPR, and now, you know, we're $10 lower on crude oil prices. I'm already starting to accumulate calls on crude oil futures, just in very small size this morning, because I don't think it's over yet. I'll be a little more aggressive as we get to lower prices. And if we get to much lower prices, I'll really back the truck up, because I'm convinced that this is not going to last. Now, what if the SPR release is not enough? The next thing the Biden administration might consider would be to at least temporarily outlaw the export of U.S. crude oil. Keep it in the United States in order to protect Americans. Now, if you've listened to my interviews with Pat Hemsworth or Anas Al-Haji over the years, you know that that doesn't accomplish the stated goal, because crude quality matters. And what we have coming out of the U.S. shale patch is ultra light sweet crude, which you can't even do anything with in a U.S. refinery until you blend it with heavy blend stock, with heavier sour oil that creates a grade of oil after blending that is suitable for refining. The way you get more of that, if you were actually trying to solve this problem, would be to look, and you know, this is something that the Biden administration ought to consider, since they seem to be very much focused on undoing anything that President Trump did. If you were to get Iran and Venezuelan imports coming back in, that provides you with the blend stock that you need if you actually wanted to disallow U.S. exports. If you had that blend stock, which Iran and Venezuela are both excellent sources of, then you might be able to do something with that extra oil. But if you just outlaw exports, what you're going to do is you're going to create an imbalanced situation where there's a whole bunch of oil piling up that nobody can refine because they don't have enough blend stock in order to create a refinable grade out of it. You would think that the president of the United States and his administration would be smart enough to understand this stuff. But history teaches us they don't. They think crude oil is crude oil, and if we stop exporting it, we'll have more, and that just solves the problem. They don't think it through beyond that level, so far as I can tell. So I don't think that a ban on U.S. exports is going to accomplish anything either. And frankly, I don't think there's anything that the Biden administration can do to change the fact that we have an extremely bullish setup here. There has been a lack of investment in finding new producing resources. That is, over the next several years, going to set up much, much higher prices. Part of that is the ESG trend, and part of that is Biden administration policies. What the Biden administration appears to want to do next is to vilify big oil and blame the oil companies and blame OPEC Plus and create even more enemies. These things are not going to help bring the price of energy down in the long run, but they could very well result in a short-term spike down. And if so, I think it's a tremendous buying opportunity. In any event, Patrick, let's move on, since I just hijacked your whole chart deck for way longer than I was supposed to there, to slide four. It's your turn again, since it's your chart deck. What's going on with silver futures?
Well, you know what? What is interesting for me is that silver has been in a pronounced downtrend ever since putting in that January, February highs at the start of the
year. It's going to 1,000, dude. I read it on Wall Street Silver.
Definitely. And but one way or another, what we finally seen in September was a blow off bottom. And what may be developing is an inverted head and shoulders pattern breakout that may be setting in motion a new trend. It's interesting because silver, obviously cousin to gold, is breaking out roughly about the same time, which is nice to see that the two are more or less running in unison. But it'll be interesting to see whether this is the beginning of a new bull run on silver with much more reasonable targets than 1,000.
And on page five, finally, the S&P chart. I knew it was coming eventually.
Right.
And there hasn't been a break. There hasn't been a new high for a whole week. My God, the market is crashing.
Well, you know what? It is interesting because in very typical fashion, there was a very large, it is option expiration tomorrow, the OPEX, into a monthly expiry. And there is a lot of gamma in those options. There's huge open interest. I was just reading Charlie McElligott's piece. There's a huge amount of gamma open interest at the 4,700 strike, something to the tune of $9 billion. And above there at 4,750 on the S&P is another $6.7 billion. billion. And so with us going into this OPEX, it creates a bit of a gamma pin. It's the most common reaction is to see the market just chop into this 4,700. And that is very not a shocker that we're trading exactly there going into Friday. With that said, what will be really interesting is volatility typically returns in the post-OPEX period. The volatility can be both directions, so we don't want to immediately paint it bearish. It could also be an explosive volatile move to the upside that happens. But what's interesting is that going into this expiration, the S&P net delta was at the 99.9th percentile since 2013. But yet we have 24% of the delta rolling off and 29% of the gamma. And it's even greater on the NASDAQ, which is also in the 99th percentile. And you've got 42% of delta and 49% of the gamma rolling off. So what that implies is that it's like the thumb being pressed down on something, it's suppressing the volatility, that that thumb is being lifted. In which direction the volatility goes is something that I'll be watching next week. It's likely to be a move. And so I'm curious as to whether or not that's going to be the bullish continuation higher or whether an overdue market correction begins.
Patrick, on page 6, you've got the consumer discretionary ETF, XLY. Why that particular chart?
Well, it's been one of the big leadership ones. It's up, 30 to 40% on the year, and it's been running. And it really looks like this entire space has been just such a huge bull run. And I wanted to dig in a little bit onto this ETF, because most people, when they own a diversified ETF like this, they assume that they're getting the benefit of diversification, that they're holding a big basket of these discretionary names. But when we look on page 7 and look at the breakdown, basically Amazon is 20% of this index, Tesla is 20% of the index, and Home Depot is another 10%. I'm rounding, of course, but basically three stocks make up 50% of the holdings of this ETF. And when you look at their performance, looking at the industry breakdown on the right, that automobile space, which is basically dominated by Tesla, contributed 1,700 basis points to that performance. So this has basically been a Tesla fund. I mean, the holding is almost double of what Cathie Wood holds in ARK. And it's been really one of the big drivers of this performance. And what I'm curious about, like, again, the whole title of this chart deck is, can these trends continue? This has been a sector that has been dominated by the performance of Tesla. And when we look at page 8, Tesla had that extraordinary gamma squeeze that happened throughout October that saw this amazing run on the upside, and it has stalled. And one of the big questions for me going into next week and the week after is there more upside on Tesla? Can this all just keep feeding on itself and make another run, and will it? Or have we seen this all blow off? And now I don't want to make any crazy bold predictions, but boy, is that on my mind for next week.
Well, you didn't mention, I mean, it seems to me the blow off top here was entirely about Elon Musk's little virtue signaling moment of pretending that he was supposedly trying to be sensitive to political pressures and feelings about unrealized gains when he basically sold a shitload of stock because he knows this shit is ridiculously overvalued and he's not that stupid. At least that's how I interpret it. So I question how much more selling Elon is going to do under false pretenses and how many people are going to wake up to the ridiculous overvaluation of this stock. Where does that come into this analysis, or how do you see that fitting into the equation?
Well, it's all a part of it. I mean, ultimately, if it is, if it was driven by a gamma squeeze, it's no different than a much bigger version of GameStop and AMC. In the end, when all of that gets exhausted and runs through the system, then the stock mean reverts in a big way. And I think Elon Musk is taking advantage of it and doing some selling like any smart investor would do after being lucky enough to hold it on the way up. Anyway, I certainly don't blame him for selling some. I would have done the same.
Well, Michael Burry has been very outspoken on that. We heard a rumor that Michael Burry is a regular listener of Macro Voices. If that's true, sir, we would love to be the first one to persuade you to do an interview, because we'd do it better than those idiots on CNBC. Anyway, moving on.
Moving on. Yeah, let's touch on the emerging markets on page 9. And what I just want to highlight is emerging markets are flat on the year. just have not had anything to do with this upside on the market. Struggling places like Brazil, the China, a lot of the Asian markets have been dogging it. Generally, emerging markets have been stuck in the mud. And what is interesting about this is when you look at page 10, I thought it was a really interesting factor analysis of looking at the emerging markets against the S&P 500 going back a decade. And what's amazing is just how much relative outperformance the S&P 500 has against emerging markets. This has been an extraordinary bull run in the S&P on a relative basis. And this trend has been dominant for a decade. At some point, especially if driven by a commodity turnaround, obviously emerging markets are struggling a bit. Everything from, you know, being behind the curve on COVID to the fact that the US dollar has been strong. But at some stage, I think that there might be an opportunity to catch a trend change in this. Obviously, this is not something that a 10-year trend does not turn on a dime in a week or two. But boy, is it going to be interesting to see when emerging markets start to come back into play.
10-year trend, and I'm sure it has nothing to do with quantitative easing and central bank largesse.
No, it couldn't. It couldn't.
Can't be.
Couldn't,
just a possibly. Coincidence. Gotta be. And of course, listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart techs, you can get them every single day with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's service. You'll find information on page 11 or at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abaxx Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Escrow.com, the world's most secure online payment system from a counterparty risk perspective, because the funds sit in escrow. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to Jeffrey Snyder's chart deck and the chart book we just discussed here in the post game. There's also a link to an FT article, The FOMO Rally, Fear of Missing Out Helps Fuel the Soaring Markets, and a Jesse Felder article, The Fasten the Seatbelt Sign Just Lit Up. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. That's Eric spelled with a K, and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors.
Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.